Hi, I am Father Russell Pollitt from the Jesuit Institute, and you are tuned in to Radio Veritas, where we bring you the good news for a change.
Time is now 15 minutes past 7 on Radio Veritas, and a very good morning to Father Russell Pollitt. Good morning, Russell.
Good morning, Father Emil.
It's a great day. Are you back in Johannesburg?
I have been for a little while now.
Okay, I always think of you outside of Johannesburg with your busy schedule.
Yes, well, Russell, at the moment I'm in Johannesburg.
Well,
enjoying this summer that came upon us instead of spring.
Beautiful, beautiful, lovely weather. Russell, great news. Now we got this new motu proprio from Rome, and about this the mass translations, the responsibility now resting on the local bishops' conference instead of Rome. I'm sure you've got a comment about this, because I certainly received this news with great joy.
Yes, you know, this whole question of translation has sort of been a political football for a long time.
Mm.
We need to go back. You know, when the Mass was first translated into English after the Second Vatican Council, that translation was the one that we used right up until 2011, I think it was, when the new one was implemented. But in between that time, in 1997, a translation was produced, and a well-known South African was very much part of that, who had been himself part of the whole translation of the first English translation of the Vatican II, and that was Archbishop Dennis Hurley.
Mm-hmm.
They produced this text. They worked for many years. In actual fact, I think that they worked for over 20 years on that 1997 translation.
Right.
What they tried to do was pick up on every single Sunday, for example, the sort of symbolism of the gospel, pick up on the, or whatever the gospel was, so that the prayers of the Mass matched the gospel and things like that.
Right.
Then what happened was there was a kind of coup that took place, and we had a change in the rules of translation, which means that the translation of 1997 was completely scotched overnight.
Yeah.
And they said that we will no longer be using what we call dynamic equivalence, which means that you translate from the original into a more kind of colloquial English that people, English that people be familiar with. It's a dynamic equivalent, not word for word. I mean, you can never translate word for word. This is completely silly to think you can. But they decided just after that they would, Rome decided, Rome, whoever that was, this Vox Clara, ISEL, decided, which is the International Commission for English in the Liturgy, they decided that they wouldn't do that, that they would go for much more direct translation from the Latin, and that's why we got what we got.
Right.
Pope Benedict changed those translation rules, if I remember correctly. Anyway, now Pope Francis has said he hasn't changed those rules yet for translation, in the sense that he instituted a committee that would look at the whole question of translations of that Liturgical Mythicum, which is the document that said how things should be translated. There's an investigation into that. But what he has done in the meantime is say that, as you said, local bishops' conferences are now responsible for the translation of the Mass wherever they find themselves. He's using this principle of subsidiarity, which is something the Church has always done, and was very strong at Vatican II. And many people feel that after Vatican II, there was a huge, big movement to try and pull back authority from bishops and bishops' conferences and centralize everything in Rome. Well, this is a move where Pope Francis is definitely decentralizing and saying to local bishops, you're in charge of translations. Once you've done translations that you're happy with, send them to Rome for approval. But he's no longer saying that Rome has to do the translations. This does mean it is possible that some conferences may decide to go back to the translation which we had before, or do a new translation. I suspect this won't happen, but it seems from what I've read and from what liturgical experts are saying, it could mean that technically bishops could decide as a conference to go back to to, for example, what we had, or maybe even consider that 1997 translation.
Yeah. Well, I would certainly hope something like that happens because, I mean, I continue just to... I growl inside myself every time I have to use this new translation. Sometimes I get to the end of the preface, I say to myself, now what on earth was that about?
Yeah, you know, the problem is as well that this translation, it's not just the content and the way things are said.
Yeah.
It's just simply bad English.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, yeah.
So you've got two problems. I mean, I think there's a theological problem with it. That comes out all over the place.
Yeah.
But we have just plain bad English. Just this last weekend, I had four masses on Sunday. I was helping out.
Yeah.
And I noticed, I can't remember where it was exactly, but I noticed that, you know, the first four or five lines of one of the prayers or something like that was completely unpunctuated.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
then when the punctuation did appear, it wasn't a full stop, it was a comma.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, what am I supposed to do, take a breath to read this whole paragraph with one comma?
Yes. Well, you know, Russell, one wonders what will happen now. I mean, will the bishops in South Africa say, well, if priests want to, or if we're going to do this in South Africa, we'll just go back to that translation we used for 40 years. Why not? I'd be very happy to do that. I have no problem with the previous translation.
Yeah, you see, the big problem here is, and I think we're moving to a space where people are going to start to admit this.
Yeah.
And I think that some people did at the time it was changed.
Yeah.
This translation business, it seems to me, if one reads it and analyzes the whole move to translate, unfortunately, was not done for pastoral good, for liturgical good, for the good of the language, or anything like that.
Mm.
The real issue was people with power. It was a political game going on. And I think this translation was the result of a political football.
Mm.
And therefore, when you have that sort of thing happening, you never get the best.
Right.
Because rather than setting out to do a good job, we had people setting out to prove a point or to try and basically bolster an ideology of how things should be.
Yeah, very good point. Good point you're making there. Well, anyway, let's wait and see. So, you feel a bit hopeful?
Yeah, I think, and you know, I mean, I think that it's very interesting that the Pope has done this. And you know, there's been no reaction yet, as far as I can make out, from Cardinal Sarah, who's in charge of the Congregation for Divine Worship.
Mm.
What I found fascinating is the whole way the Pope did this. It seems that, from what I've read, he did not really consult with that Congregation for Divine Worship. This motu proprio came straight from him. It looks like he worked around the Roman Curia to do this. You know, we know that Cardinal Sarah, who's in charge of the Congregation for Divine Worship, is someone who is seen as a major opponent of Pope Francis.
Yeah.
He has uttered a number of times things in stark contradiction to what the Pope himself has said.
Mm.
Some people are saying, how much longer can he remain in that job when he seems to contradict the Pope, you know? Mm. He hasn't reacted to this. I mean, just a year ago now, he was calling for priests to turn to what they call liturgical Eastern and say Mass with their back to the people.
Yes.
And the Pope had to say, this is not going to happen.
Right.
So this is going to be interesting to see the way that this whole thing plays out.
Mm.
But there's a real sense that Francis, you know, is... with the folks that he does have, he's a pastoral man, and he realizes, yeah, this thing is a pastoral problem.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that he's realized it, because I wonder if other languages have had the same kind of problems that we've had.
But you see, they haven't. So this is the other issue.
Yeah.
Why the English conferences all over the world, South Africa included, ran to this new translation, which... it seems was put together very fast. We know it's a shoddy translation. We know that it's not proper English.
Yeah.
Why they ran to do it is a question that no one's able to answer.
Mm.
Because if one looks at other conferences like the French, like the Germans, like the Italian, the Germans said, we're not changing. We're not going to change our current translation into one, you know, of almost trying to translate directly from the Latin. They just refused to do it.
Okay.
The Italians said, oh, yeah, we're doing it, and they never put pen to paper as the Italians do.
Mm.
You know, the French landed up, having a big debate about it. So in effect, what's happened is the French, the Germans, and the Italians now have the ability to translate into, you know, the vernacular, German, French, whatever, and decide on it themselves. They're not going to have a translation imposed upon them by Rome.
Right,
but the English bishops' conferences, for some reason, felt that they had to say yes, amen, straight away. Mm. And the thing, I sometimes wonder if we have what we have because it was also rushed.
Mm.
I mean, it wasn't thought through.
Mm.
If you think about that 1997 translation, which Archbishop Hurley said, you know, they'd worked on for more or less 20 years.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, you know, in 5 or 6 years, we got what we got.
Yeah.
You know, one has to wonder what was really going on there.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, you know, in a way, I read somewhere in a translation of a German paper the other day that one of the German bishops said, yes, we've been vindicated.
So
that's quite interesting.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting indeed. But, you know, the other thing that annoys me about this whole new translation is the millions of rands or dollars, call it what you like, that have been spent on printing costs.
Yeah.
It's just
Well, let's not even go there. I mean, you know, besides the imposition of a text which is grammatically and, you know, syntax and all that kind of stuff is obscure and doesn't work.
Mm.
You have this huge cost of printing. And, you know, I mean, I would say even the quality of the books that we have now are not the same quality as what we had before.
Absolutely.
Even the book itself. I mean, I've noticed in a few places where I've helped out how the books are already starting to split and break. And we never had that with the old book.
Not
I mean,
at all.
You know, many of those
not
old books still have the original covers on, you know, the one from 1967.
The old is good enough. Then we read that in scripture somewhere. The old is good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not against change. I mean,
no,
I think change is good.
Yes,
but I think when you're doing change for the sake of change because you're politically trying to prove a point, this is not a good reason to change.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, then. Thank you for those comments, Russell. What now? You've written a piece in the Daily Maverick about hope in a time of moral rot. What's that about?
Oh, yeah, no, that wasn't in the Daily Maverick. That was in the Institute's Weekly last week.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
You know, a few weeks ago you asked me the question, and I really sort of struggled to answer. To say, you know, how do we hope in anything given the current political situation that we live in? I mean, how do we teach young people any sense of morals when, you know, around us all the time we just hear one sort of, you know, morally bankrupt story after another?
Mm.
And last week, of course, we had at the beginning of the week, we had that whole Bell Pottinger business,
right?
And just how there seemed to be no ethical standard there whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
The day after that story broke, we had Andrew Singh, who, you know, who clearly had his fingers in the till with Transnet and with Eskom and was in bed with Brian Molefe and pinched I don't know how much money and was given kickbacks by the Guptas.
Right.
And how do we bring people up? You know, how do we give them some sense of morality when every single day in this country, you know, there's another story that bleeds and you just see how morally bankrupt things are? The question was worrying me, and I happened to notice on Facebook a young lady who was turning 13, becoming a teenager, they would say.
Right, yes.
And I saw an invitation saying, instead of a party, I want you to donate money. Instead of buying me a present or coming to a party, I want you to donate money to reach for a dream so that I can help other children to at least, realize their dreams.
Mm.
And so I inquired a little bit about this. I got hold of the mother of this young lady, and I asked her, you know, what's the deal? And she said, it sort of is a tradition in the community where they live that when you turn 13, you have to have a disco and you have to invite your whole class. And she said, Mommy, I really don't want to do this. She said, okay, what do you want to do? And this young lady said that.
Yes. Yeah.
And I thought, if this is how young people are thinking, there is hope.
Wonderful,
This is how 12-year-olds are thinking now.
Mm.
Maybe there is hope for the future. And so, those are the kind of people we need to be looking towards.
Right.
And, you know, the parents were telling me afterwards that this is completely unprompted. You know, that this came from herself.
Right.
So I found that a very hopeful story, and I found it one that's encouraging. And when we faced with the Guptas and Bell Pottinger and now this latest disaster of the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal, where, you know, there's so much skullduggery and unethical behavior and so forth. Here is a 12-year-old who thinks like that.
Yeah.
There's hope.
giving us hope, showing us the way to the future. And I must say, Reach for a Dream Foundation is an incredible foundation, and nice that this young girl realizes that too.
Yeah, I mean, I heard that she did quite a lot of research.
All right.
You know, to find something that she could have money donated to, and so forth, you know. So it was rather interesting. And like I say, I think that's a hopeful story. And
wonderful.
I think our young people may have a better sense of moral compass than many people in leadership in this country across the spectrum at the moment.
I know it. There we go. Well, thanks for doing that. Wonderful idea and a great initiative on your part there, Father Russell. Okay, let's move on to the final thing that we might like to talk about. Anything new happening at the Jesuit Institute?
Well, I think, Father Emil, we began yesterday publicity for what we're going to be calling Spotlight.Africa, which is a new publication.
Right.
That is going to be published. It's not really the Jesuit Institute per se. It's under the auspices of the Jesuit Institute, but it will be acting independently. Claire Matheson is going to be the editor of that. Claire would be well known to many people in
yes.
the Catholic world.
Right.
She worked for the Southern Cross for a number of years.
Right.
She's going to edit that online platform. It's going to launch pretty soon. We're just waiting for the technical aspects of the site to be sorted out. We've been working on this now for about 18 months or so. And it's going to offer people in Southern Africa, Catholics in Southern Africa, Christians in Southern Africa, the ability to analyze and think through things that are happening around us, interpreting what's happening around us in the light of, you know, Christian ethics, Catholic tradition, and so on and so on. It's not going to be churchy or preachy, but it's going to be a sort of analytical commentary site. It will obviously analyze and comment on news issues, but it's not going to be a news site per se that's going to sort of have every single news story up there. But it'll be looking at significant things in Southern Africa, in the church, and also in the broader church world, you know, covering people like Pope Francis, offering good analysis from an African perspective on the things that he's doing and he's saying. So Spotlight.Africa is set to launch in the next couple of weeks, we hope,
right.
as soon as the technical aspects have been sorted out. It's incredible how these things get very, one would think that setting something like that up with all the technology we have would be something simple. Well, putting it together is something simple, but actually getting, you know, hosting companies and all sorts of things to all come together at the same time and do what they're supposed to do,
yeah.
where you can sort of, you know, fly to the moon on your cell phone, but they can't do that. It's been incredible to watch
yeah.
how clunky the system can still be.
Mm.
And so that's going to happen soon, so we're very excited about that.
Yeah.
It's a new project. And the other thing is that this coming Saturday, I've been asked to mention, we will be talking about should the church be involved in politics at Malvern Catholic Church. It's the Lay Leaders Conference, which is held annually, hosted by the Department of Evangelization of the Archdiocese of Johannesburg. And we will be looking at the question of the church and politics, which is one which is a hot potato at the moment, given the fact that politicians seem to be appearing in front of bishops for blessings. So should the church be involved in politics? It looks like the church is already involved in politics. The question is, what should the church be doing in politics?
Right.
And that's the question we will try and pursue on Saturday at Malvern, 9:30. Anybody's invited to come to that. It's for lay leaders in the Archdiocese of Johannesburg. But as far as I can make out, anyone who wants to come is welcome.
Very good. Now, thanks very much for that. I hope that's going to go well.
Thank you.
And that's it. Anything more?
I can't think of anything more unless
okay.
I've skipped something or
All
you've
right.
got something in your mind that I've slipped mine.
No, I suppose, you know, we know already on Radio Veritas that the good lady, what's her name?
Oh,
Frances Correa.
Yes, will be leaving us at the end of the month.
Yes, yes, yes.
I know that you did an interview with her last week.
That's right,
so
yes.
So Frances has decided to move on, really because of family responsibility. That's the key issue. I know it's been a very difficult decision for her.
Yeah.
So we will certainly miss Frances. She'll leave a gap.
Yeah.
And we will have to, as the GPSs say, we're going to have to start recalculating.
That's right. Rerouting now, too.
Rerouting. There we go.
Yes. All right, Father Russell, thank you very much indeed. Always lovely talking to you.
Thank you.
God bless you and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too. All the best.
Thank you. There we go. That was Father Russell Pollitt, the director of the Jesuit Institute here in Johannesburg, and he was talking to us about a couple of important things, the new translations or the new ruling, or what's called a motu proprio, which has been issued by the Holy Father with regard to translations of the liturgy now being decentralized, and this principle of subsidiarity kicking in here, that local bishops' conferences will have a lot more say than simply the Roman Curia. And then he's spoken about his little piece, which is written, called Hope in a Time of Moral Rot, and then some things about what's happening this coming weekend. 35 minutes past 7.
Hi, I am Father Russell Pollitt from the Jesuit Institute, and you are tuned in to Radio Veritas, where we bring you the good news for a change.